Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated October 19th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Today's first article, Tort Law Tied to Fall in Malpractice Rates, by Jason DeBrune from Raleigh. Rates for medical malpractice insurance have been in decline for 5 years, and a year-old state law that slapped restrictions on lawsuits is being credited with taking them down further. Doctors buying insurance from Medical Mutual Insurance Company of North Carolina are paying an average of $11,500 for their coverage this year. That's down from $16,000, an all-time high, in 2007. That's a pretty good drop, says Dale Jenkins, CEO of Medical Mutual, the state's largest insurer of physicians. Rates have been dropping for half a decade, both in North Carolina and nationwide. The aggregate decline in direct written premiums is nearly 20% since 2006, when the national market hit an all-time high of $12.5 billion in premiums written. That shrank to $10 billion by 2011. On average, malpractice insurance rates are down by 10% for family physicians in North Carolina this year, says Dr. Brian Forrest, president of the North Carolina Academy of Family Physicians. Forrest and others in the medical community say North Carolina's year-old law has helped extend the 5-year decline in rates. Robert Seligson, CEO of the North Carolina Medical Society, says, "We worked for 18 years to get sensible malpractice reform passed in North Carolina." Seligson says further, "Crunching is needed before a solid link can be established between the North Carolina law and lower rates, though the prevailing view is that such a link exists." Atlanta-based MAG Mutual Insurance Company, North Carolina's second-largest medical malpractice insurer, cut its premiums by 7% for 2012 in expectation of lower claims in the state. The law went into effect October 1, 2011, putting a cap of $500,000 on non-economic damages, awards for pain, stress, and other non-quantifiable factors. It does not cap economic damages, which are intended to compensate plaintiffs for medical cost, lost earning capacity, and other specific losses. Not everyone has greeted the lower rates with high praise, however, as the most recent rates extend the longest soft market the medical malpractice insurance industry has ever seen, according to Michael Matre, editor for the Medical Liability Monitor, a monthly trade publication published in Oak Park, Illinois, that tracks the medical malpractice insurance industry. Raleigh-based Medical Mutual is owned by its customers, so it takes a bit of a different perspective on what constitutes a soft market. Running the business can be tricky in this climate, Jenkins says, but that also means the owners of the company are paying lower premiums through their practices. This is sobering when one considers that direct written premiums had fallen for 2 consecutive years, only once previously, says Chad Carls, a consulting actuary for Seattle-based Milliman Incorporated, a risk management consultant. As with all discussions on health care spending, experts offer the reminder that some seemingly huge savings can amount to only a small percentage of total spending. The Journal of American Medical Association estimates annual U.S. health care spending to be more than $2.6 trillion, the equivalent of the world's fifth largest national economy. The Congressional Budget Office has estimated that broad tort reforms would result in national savings of $11 billion per year, or about one-half of 1% of overall medical spending. More than half of the states have implemented some measures to limit medical malpractice suits, though some people are skeptical of their success. If these measures have reduced costs, they are insufficient to counter other factors in increasing cost. Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, faculty member at the University of Pennsylvania Center for Bioethics, wrote in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Still on the front page, a mortgage sector Jobs Decimated During Downfall by Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. Turmoil in financial and housing markets over the past 4 years has hammered North Carolina's financial services industry, slashing the ranks of mortgage loan officers, for example, from 16,517 to 6,940, a reduction of 58%. Loan officers weren't the only ones taking a hit. Mortgage brokers, who act as conduits between lenders and borrowers, have been reduced in force by 82% to 152 firms as of October, down from 841 in March 2008. Meanwhile, the number of offices they maintained statewide shrank from 311 to just 34. The figures come from the Office of North Carolina Commissioner of Banks, which keeps a running tally of the financial services firms it licenses and regulates in 8 distinct groups. A comparison of a March 2008 list with one completed in early October reveals how hard times have reshaped the industry. The most dramatic changes were in jobs related to mortgage financing. In addition to the stark decline in loan officers, the ranks of mortgage lenders, firms actually providing the cash for home loans, have also taken a hit. Their numbers fell by 55% over the past 4 years, from 726 to 336, according to the Commissioner of Banks. I wouldn't have thought the losses would be that high, says Durham attorney Robert Love, a member of the Triangle Mortgage Lenders Association. Love actually lists 2007 as the year when the first cracks began appearing in parts of the state's housing sector. Within 6 months of the onset of the downturn, he says the dearth of business was prompting mortgage professionals to let their licenses lapse. Other parts of the financial services industry also have taken a hit, albeit for different reasons. According to the records, there has been a 62% drop in the number of organizations writing tax refund anticipation loans, from 842 4 years ago to 316 now. Consumers pay a fee to secure a RAL against an expected tax refund check. In recent years, the practice has come under the scrutiny of advocacy groups, including Durham-based Reinvestment Partners, which claimed that the large banks funding the loans weren't keeping a close enough watch on their loan processing partners in the field. As a result of the ensuing controversy, some notable players, banks like J.P. Morgan Chase and HSBC, and loan writers like H&R Block, have pulled back from the business, Reinvestment Partners Director Peter Skillerin says. Also, there's been a 34% decline in the number of consumer loan officers across the state, with their numbers contracting to 378 in 2012, from 570 4 years ago. The companies generally write direct loans of $10,000 or less. Skillerin believes the decline is due in part to the passing of a number of mom-and-pop operations from the scene. And the number of commercial banks operating in the state is down by nearly 20%, from 73 in 2008 to 59 now. However, the number of bank holding companies, 61 4 years ago, is 57 now, a relatively stable performance. These results point to consolidation in the industry, banking expert Don Coker says. Not all financial services industries are so downtrodden. On the consumer side, money transmitters grew by 15% over the 4 years to 81 firms, while the number of check cashing establishments rose by 3% to 1,481. This week's lead article on the front page, Vendor Sales Up at the Airport. With carriers charging for food, some passengers are eating before boarding. By Chris Bagley from Morrisville. Managers at Raleigh-Durham International Airport are celebrating strong sales growth at new Terminal 2 restaurants and shops, a key source of revenue they're watching closely as they prepare to solicit bids for new spaces that will open following the renovation of Terminal 1. Concessionaires in Terminal 2, which opened in stages in 2010 and early 2011, took in about $23.3 million between January and August, nearly 4% more than in the first 8 months of 2011. Concessionaires with particularly strong growth included the business clothier Brooks Brothers, Five Guys Burgers and Fries, and the airport's multiple Starbucks locations. Concessionaires are chains and franchisees of retailers, restaurants, and other service providers that pay a percentage of their sales to the airport, along with regular fixed amounts that are based partly on square footage. The airport's cut of concessionaire sales ranges from 9% to 15%, so growing sales translates into increased revenue for the airport. Concessionaires account for about $6.1 million of the $95 million in revenue that RDU expects in its current fiscal year. RDU spokeswoman Mindy Hamblin says the airport's concessions revenue for the first 6 months of its 2012-13 fiscal year is on budget. The year began April 1st. The concession revenue figures will be on airport officials' minds in November when they send out requests for proposals to potential vendors for Terminal 1, where renovated sections are scheduled to open in early 2014. Ingrid Hairston, Business Development Director for the airport, says she'll be looking for restaurants and retailers with both cachet and staying power. Would-be vendors that agree to share larger percentages of their revenue with the airport may have an advantage, Hairston says. So will those with attractive decor and, in some cases, those that celebrate the location. We would like for you to know that you're in North Carolina and that you're in the Triangle, Hairston says. Airlines are scraping to offer passengers the lowest possible airfare while beginning to charge for meals and a wide range of other items. As a result, airports are coming under new pressure to offer airlines the lowest possible lease rates and landing fees and beginning to derive larger percentages of their own operating profit from concessions, parking, and other ancillary services. That helps to control costs for their primary tenants, the carriers, says Sean Broderick, a vice president at the American Association of Airport Executives. There are tremendous cost pressures on the airlines. Many passengers, meanwhile, are responding to the onboard charges by eating before or after their flights, Broderick says. Hairston declines to specify the full range of tenants she'll be seeking for the terminal, but one typical concept is a casual dining restaurant with a bar. The airport may solicit proposals from several national fast food restaurants, a smaller number of regional fast food eateries, and a range of casual dining restaurants, a category that includes the 42nd Street Oyster Bar and Chili's Grill and Bar. The renovated Terminal 1 will have a range of spaces for retailers, restaurants, and other service providers such as currency changers. The airport's figures show concessions revenue from Terminal 1 falling steeply this year amid the preparations for the renovations. Some shops decamped for Terminal 2 when it opened, while others have left the airport entirely. All told, including both terminals, concessionaires' revenue in the first 8 months of the calendar year rose by about 0.5% to $29 million. Hamblin notes that total includes both the airport's 2011 and 12 fiscal year and the current fiscal year, and says that the conservative budgeting has helped ensure that revenue is coming in above what was budgeted. Next up, Mega Gym Plotted for False of New Site by Amanda Jones Hoyle from Raleigh. Triangle golfers have been pinging practice shots at the Falls Golf Complex on False of the Noose Road for more than 30 years. But a plan to build a Lifetime Fitness Mega Gym complex at the site could put an end to all those swings. Lifetime Fitness, a Chanhassen, Minnesota-based health club company whose shares are traded on the New York Stock Exchange, has submitted a request to the city to rezone 26-acre property to allow for construction of a 106,000-square-foot health club campus. The private, members-only health club would have many of the same amenities as a Lifetime Fitness club that opened on Regency Parkway in Cary in 2006. Indoor and outdoor swimming pools, a gymnasium, a fitness center, a restaurant, a child care facility, a salon, and a spa. But the project could face scrutiny because of its location at the edge of the Falls Lake secondary water supply watershed, including streams that feed into Raleigh's primary drinking water source. Lifetime Fitness spokesman Jason Thunstrom did not return calls for comment, but sources say the company has been scouting for sites for several years to build a second mega gym in the region. The big clubs are their bread and butter, says Michael Olander, Jr., president and CEO of the O2 Fitness Health Club, company based in Raleigh and a competitor to Lifetime. They're a good company, but it's an entirely different experience from what we offer, he says of Lifetime. O2 Fitness has a 26,000-square-foot facility that's about a half mile from the property where Lifetime Fitness wants to build. Olander believes Lifetime would be a more direct competitor of the nonprofit A.E. Finley YMCA facility about 3 miles away on Bailiwick Road. The Finley YMCA also has an indoor and outdoor swimming pool, a fitness club, and child care programs. A single adult membership at the YMCA starts at $39 a month with a $110 joining fee. Membership at the Lifetime Fitness Club in Cary is around $70 a month. Lifetime Fitness also operates three smaller format fitness facilities in Raleigh and in Apex that it acquired from Lifestyle Family Fitness in December. The property where Lifetime wants to build in North Raleigh near the intersection of Interstate 540 has been operated as a golf driving range since the 1970s, according to documents filed with the Raleigh Planning Department in September. A mini golf course with 36 holes was added in 1999, along with a golf store and snack bar. If the driving range is closed, it would leave golfers with fewer options to practice. The Capital T Golf Practice Facility on Yonkers Road in Raleigh was closed in June after its property was sold to St. David's School, a private Episcopal K-12 school that will develop the land for its athletic fields and facilities. Golfers without membership at clubs with a driving range would have to look elsewhere, perhaps to the Triangle Golf Complex on Leesville Road in North Raleigh that is co-owned by Raleigh businessmen Benny Dean and John McConnell, CEO of McConnell Golf. Dean also is one of the owners of the Falls Golf Complex. And now, in the wake of sale, owners aim to write Nitronex by Lauren K. Onisorge from Durham. Once a darling among Triangle Tech startups, with a semiconductor technology developed at NC State University, Nitronex Corporation has 30% fewer workers than at its peak and is struggling to turn a profit. Greg Baker, who took over as CEO in early October, says staffing was cut before the company's acquisition by GAAS Labs LLC, a California private equity firm, in June. Headcount is now at 40, down from 60 in 2010. While the company reported revenue of $10 million in 2010, it's unprofitable. Baker was not immediately available to provide a revenue figure for 2011. Baker says the previous owners were tight on cash and cut back before the sale. I believe they were pretty much poised for higher volume of sales, but the market didn't take off, Baker says. The company's primary new owner, GAAS Labs CEO John Ocampo, is well-funded, Baker says. Back in March 2010, then-CEO Charles Shalvoy characterized the company as just starting to sprout. Funded by venture capital of more than $100 million since its launch in 1999, Nitronex had already topped $5 million in annual revenue, Shalvoy said at the time. Regarding the $100 million, Baker says, "It's very expensive running a semiconductor company with the process development and the wafer fabrication. That last process, creating the wafers onto which chemicals are added to create the chips, is where much of the money went," he says. Shalvoy did not return requests for comment, and many of Nitronex's senior managers are either out or on the way out. Baker confirms that Jim DeVivio is transitioning out of the company as finance director. Nitronex develops gallium nitride on silicon for radio frequency power transistors and has received funding from Durham's InterSouth Partners, the Silicon Valley firm Vantage Point Venture Partners, Chicago-based Arch Venture Fund, and the California-based firms Diamondhead Ventures and Alloy Ventures. Baker believes Nitronex was moving in the right direction before the acquisition by outsourcing its wafer fabrication to Torrance, California-based Global Communications Semiconductor, LLC. But cutting expenses by outsourcing wasn't enough to turn the company around, he says. That's where GAAS Labs came in, essentially bailing out Nitronex in the acquisition, financial terms of which have not been disclosed. Baker says the company is concentrating on the future, outsourcing and creating new products to attract market interest, but much of that future is uncertain. The company doesn't know, for example, where it will relocate after completing the sale of its building on Presidential Drive to Charlotte-based Five Nines Digital, LLC. Adele Somerville, Nitronex's Human Resources Director, says the company will stay in its 82,500-square-foot location for about a year and then will relocate. Baker says the intent is to keep Nitronex in the Triangle. He lives in Dallas, Texas, and commutes. But the company, which once was promised a $100,000 incentives grant from Durham County to move its headquarters and expand in the county, will not need as much space as it has once hoped. That $100,000 was never paid because Nitronex didn't keep its end of the deal in terms of job growth, and Baker doesn't see that promised growth happening in the near future. The company has been able to keep its pre-acquisition client list. There were some concerns with financial stability, he says, but now the financial backing is even stronger. Baker has no equity in Nitronex. It's kind of a limited partnership that's kind of controlled by John Ocampo, and so in the future I think there will be some kind of equity position, and that's something we're working on, he says. Baker knows he has work to do, but I think we're on the right track now, he says. Ocampo could not be reached for comment. Ocampo also owns Lowell, Massachusetts-based MACOM Technology Solutions. Next up, the Court of Life. Duke Banks' Birth Blood to Save Lives Later. By Jason DeBruin, from Durham. John and Leanne Howell packed for yet another 1,300-mile trip from Pflugerville, Texas, to Durham. It's a grueling trip, but it's one of the only ways for their son, Jace, to receive the care he needs. The 14-month-old Jace suffers from congenital hydrocephalus, which means he does not have the normal flow of fluid in and around his brain. At the Duke University Medical Center, he can receive a transfusion of the blood that was taken from his umbilical cord when he was born. Duke banked it to help him later. "We think it's helped," John Howell says, referring especially to Jace's vision. The transfusion doesn't make new brain cells, so to speak, but it helps repair the cells that carry fluid, and it gives Jace a better chance at leading a healthy life. A patient can also receive a transfusion of banked blood that was drawn from the umbilical cord of an unrelated infant. Special properties of the stem cells in cord blood mean that a direct match is not required for a successful transfusion. Duke University School of Medicine received approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration as a licensed cord blood bank on October 4th, making it only the third bank in the United States to receive that designation. Duke and the Carolinas Cord Blood Bank, a nonprofit public cord blood bank at the medical school, have been pioneers in the area and in 1993 actually performed the world's first successful transplant of unrelated cord blood. Dr. Joan Kurtzberg, director of Duke's Pediatric Blood and Marrow Transplant Program, was a trailblazer in their use for transplants and was a founder of the public bank through CCBB. The FDA designation could bring financial rewards to the blood bank and Duke. It cost the bank about $3,100 to collect and store a sample, but the bank can charge a patient $25,000 to $35,000 for an infusion of cord blood stem cells. The price is the same whether the cells are used in the same body or in an unrelated patient. The facility stores 3,000 to 4,000 new samples per year and sends 30 to 40 a month to various transplant centers throughout the country. Though the FDA has not restricted unlicensed banks from selling samples, it does nominally require banks to be licensed, and some people in the industry surmise it might enforce the requirement at some point in the future. Even if it does not, the licensure still gives the bank at Duke a sort of gold star that only two other facilities can now boast. Duke collects about 10,000 samples of cord blood a year in order to identify and bank 3,000 to 4,000 high-quality samples. The other 60 to 70% are discarded. Cord blood is blood left over inside a baby's umbilical cord. Not so long ago, it was simply discarded as medical waste. Kurtzberg and other medical pioneers discovered that it's far easier for an unrelated human body to tolerate, so a direct match is not necessary for bone marrow transplants, for example. Too often, leukemia patients die because they cannot find a perfect match. But cells from cord blood allow doctors to offer the same outcome even without a perfect match, making a successful transplant more likely. Kurtzberg says the full science is not fully understood, but it has to do with the fact that a baby has DNA from the mother and father while living inside the mother. The mother doesn't reject the baby, and the baby doesn't reject the mother, Kurtzberg says. So, cord blood is more tolerant of a new person. Cord blood researchers solicit volunteers to donate cord blood, which is extracted from a placenta. That process happens after birth and comes with no risk to either the mother or the infant. Banks extract stem cells from the blood and store them for future use. Only about 5% of births involve such a donation, according to the Cord Blood Registry, a private blood bank headquartered in San Bruno, California. Such private banks function like a safety deposit box at a regular bank, the kind where you have your checking account, says Kathy Engel, a spokeswoman for the Cord Blood Registry. A family pays an upfront fee, usually about $2,000, and an annual storage fee of about $125. In a public bank such as Duke, the bank covers all the costs of procuring, testing, and storing cord blood. The bank then owns the cord blood unit and lists the sample on a worldwide registry where it can be obtained for anyone in the world who matches to the unit and needs a transplant. In a private bank, the family always owns the cell sample. Public banks storing unrelated donor cord blood units are regulated by the FDA, while private banks are not. Continuing inside the Triangle Business Journal this week, hotel joins mix for delayed Parkside Commons in Cary. By Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Cary. The developers of the proposed $135 million Parkside Town Commons project in West Cary are adding a hotel and shifting the focus to more retail versus residential. A new plan submitted to the town of Cary shows that Kite Realty Group, the Indianapolis-based developer of the project, has eliminated plans for office buildings, reduced the amount of small shop space, changed plans for an apartment complex, and added a 140-room hotel. Parkside Town Commons would be on a site at the intersection of O'Kelly Chapel Road and NC 55, near the exit ramp for the Triangle Expressway. The property abuts the boundary line for the Research Triangle Park near the campuses for Fidelity Investments, Cisco Systems, and NetApp. Few of the changes would impact the first phase of the project, on which construction could begin in 2013, says Mark Jenkins, a senior vice president with Kite Realty. The first phase is expected to be anchored by a Target store and a Harris Teeter grocery store, although neither retailer has confirmed plans for the location, which is projected to have 243,000 square feet of retail and restaurant space. It's been 5 years since the original plans for Parkside Town Commons were submitted to the town, and much has changed regarding the expectations of the real estate market since that time, Jenkins explains. For the northern piece, it's a complete redesign, he says. We're starting all over. Jenkins says the earlier plan incorporated more small shops, but the shift of the economy has hit smaller retail operators much harder than the larger anchor and junior anchor tenants, which can fill a regional shopping center quicker. Kite Realty submitted the changes so it could have more options for bigger retailers on the site. It'll be nice to have more anchors instead of depending on If you build it, they will come, Jenkins says. I can say that we've experienced a lot of activity on the site in the last 90 to 120 days. We feel real good on the leasing side. Kite Realty and its joint venture partner for the project, Prudential Real Estate Investors, have so far invested more than $64 million in the Parkside project, including $41 million that was paid for the land in 2007 and 2008, according to Wake County deed records and documents that Kite has submitted to the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. In retail development, a project's success is often determined by the amount of pre-leasing before the building is even finished. At the Holly Springs Town Center retail project that Kite Realty is building in Holly Springs, for example, nearly half of the 570,000 square feet of retail that will be opening in March is already committed to specific retail and restaurant tenants, including Target, Marshalls, Dick's Sporting Goods, and Michaels. Jenkins says the firm has already started marketing buildings for the second phase in Holly Springs. Holly Springs is going to blow people's minds when they see how many retailers are open come March 2013. We are leasing space at a velocity that is very encouraging, he says. Retail development analyst David Connor with the Lincoln Harris real estate firm in Raleigh says the developer of Parkside Town Commons shouldn't have to worry about finding tenants for the project. If you look at the growth of new homes in that area over the last 10 years, it's been off the charts, Connor says. I think there's a lot of pent-up demand for new retail and restaurants out there. Connor notes that the Parkside project would open up a new backdoor road to Research Triangle Park and to South Durham, where it extends O'Kelly Chapel Road from NC 55 east to connect to Lewis Stevens Drive across the CSX railroad tracks. According to Cary's Director of Engineering, Tim Bailey, part of the compromise to extend O'Kelly Church Road across the railroad tracks is an agreement signed by the town, CSX, and the North Carolina Department of Transportation to build a $17 million bridge over the railroad at Carpenter Fire Station Road to the north of Parkside. Kite Realty, as part of that deal, has committed to pay $500,000 towards the bridge construction project. And now, half of Triangle's employment gains are in low-paying jobs. By Chris Bagley, from Raleigh. About half of the Triangle's post-recession job growth has been concentrated in a handful of low-paying service industries, raising questions about the strength of the economic recovery here. Restaurants, hotels, retail stores, and entertainment venues such as bowling alleys employed more than 113,000 people in Wake and Durham counties in 2011, nearly 5% more than in 2009, according to a Triangle Business Journal analysis of the U.S. Labor Department data published in the summer. The local private sector grew by just 2% in those years to about 527,000 employees. The retail and hospitality sectors are noted for relatively low pay. General merchandise stores, a category that includes department stores like Macy's and discount Target stores such as Target, pay an average of $20,500 a year. Local headcount at such stores grew by 8% last year to about 15,300 as new retail locations such as Target anchored shopping center in Morrisville opened. Growth was just as dramatic among the local restaurants and bars, where headcount grew by nearly 7% to 46,000 food service employees, earned an average of $15,400 last year. That total reflects large numbers of part-time workers and excludes unreported tips, but is still far below the average pay of $52,900 in the private sector. Wake County Economic Development Director Ken Atkins notes that many such workers are young people who work part-time while studying for degrees that lead to higher-paying careers. It's important to have a well-balanced economy with healthy growth across all sectors, Atkins says. Still, restaurants and retailers, relatively low pay is one reason why economic developers don't actively seek to recruit them. North Carolina's economic development incentives generally reward companies that create jobs paying more than the local median wage, Commerce Department spokesman, the spokes, Spokesman Josh Ellis says, "To be sure, the Triangle has benefited recently from such strong growth in high-paying industries such as telecommunications and information technology. Across the Triangle's private sector as a whole, workers earned an average of $52,900 in 2011, up 5% from 2009. Still, a wide range of mid-paying industries has grown only marginally since 2009. Employment in North Carolina hospitals rose to just 0.1% between 2009 and 2011 to 113,283. In the Triangle, physician practices grew a bit less than 1% to 9,100. Several categories of manufacturing shrank. Such industries' slower growth suggests a widening gap between the top and bottom of the pay scale. Lagging incomes in the middle and bottom of the pay scale have been a drag on many of the businesses that rely on low-wage work." Morningstar analyst R.J. Hotovoy says restaurant companies are back in growth mode nationally, but have continued to rely on heavy discounting, which has kept a lid on their profit margins. As a result, individual locations are frugal in their scheduling of workers, says Hotovoy. And now, Fed program juices lending among banks in the region, by Lee Weisbecker. This article comes from Raleigh. A trio of Triangle and regional banks have been able to expand their small business lending by nearly $60 million and cut their funding costs under a U.S. Treasury-operated financial recovery program. The three lenders, Oxford-based Union Bank and Trust, First Bank of Troy, and Providence Bank of Rocky Mount, are among the 281 mostly smaller U.S. banks selected to be in the program back in 2011. Treasury posts periodic updates on the progress of the effort, showing how the banks are increasing their small business lending volumes relative to a baseline. The average loan volume for the four quarters through June 30, 2010. According to the latest update, First Bank, which received an SBLF infusion of $43 million in taxpayer dollars, has lent $42.6 million over the baseline, an increase of 8.7%. Union Bank, which received $6.2 million under the program, has lent nearly $9 million, some 23% above the base. And Providence Bank, which got $4.2 million, has lent nearly $6 million, 19.5% above the base. Interest rates on the Treasury infusions decline as banks boost lending under the program. The current highest rate is 5%. Because of their lending records, however, First Bank now pays 2.9%, and Union Bank and Providence pay just 1% each. Union Bank CEO Thomas Coombs says he has targeted small to medium-sized business to make the loans. "We see it as a very good fit for our market," he says. The U.S. Treasury Department's Neil Woolen says SBLF banks, which received $4 billion from the Treasury, have lent an estimated $6.7 billion over their baselines. Under the program's rules, a small business loan is one of less than $10 million. A small business is one with annual revenue of less than $50 million. Charlottesville, Virginia-based SNL Financial has been keeping track of which SBLF banks are using the additional cash to make acquisitions. While the objective of the program was to boost small business loans, some participants are seeking inorganic growth opportunities as well, SNL's Harris Molly says. Molly says 55 SBLF participants have been buyers in 72 deals over the past 15 months. More than half of the transactions were whole bank deals, while 25 involved acquisitions of branches only. Two SBLF banks in North Carolina are on SNL's acquire list. First Bank has bought three branches, including the Southern Pines and Rockingham branch offices of Four Oaks Bank. And Greenville-based Select Bank Corp, which received a Treasury cash infusion of $7.6 million, has bought one branch. Next up, insurers say med coupons from drug companies are boosting costs, by Jason DeBruin, This article is from Chapel Hill. Budget-conscious shoppers rightfully like the word coupon, but when it comes to pharmaceuticals, coupons may actually inflate the price. That's essentially the assertion of third-party payers such as Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina. Coupons are offered mostly by large pharmaceutical companies for branded drugs that have cheaper generic versions in the market. The coupon applies only to the patient's copayment and not to the amount that the insurer covers. The result is to nudge patients towards buying the branded drug, possibly without even realizing that the much higher cost that insurers bear. Insurers say the dynamic drives up premiums while adding to drug manufacturers' profits. The amount of coupons has exploded over the past couple of years, says Eastay Green, Director of Pharmacy Programs at Blue Cross Blue Shield North Carolina, which is headquartered in Chapel Hill and by far North Carolina's largest health insurer. As a defense, Blue Cross has developed a long list of pharmaceuticals that make pre-approval a condition for reimbursement. If a patient receives a prescription for the branded cholesterol drug Lipitor, for example, he or she might need the prescribing doctor to fill out and send an application to Blue Cross explaining the medical benefit of Lipitor versus generic versions such as atorvastatin or lovastatin, prevastatin, or simvastatin. Take the branded acne medication Solodyne as another example. It costs $600 a month, while the generic version costs a mere $10. Because a coupon can make the copays equal, however, patients can get the branded version without realizing or acknowledging what it costs the insurer, ultimately driving costs up for everyone. Members were saving but actually increasing the cost in the long run, says Green. In the United States, the Food and Drug Administration requires that a generic drug be as effective and safe as the branded name equivalent. Generics are cheaper, often slightly so, in part because generic manufacturers do not bear the expenses of developing and marketing a new drug, which often top $1 billion. GlaxoSmithKline, based in London and with North America headquarters in Research Triangle Park, offers discounts on 10 pharmaceuticals, two of which are on Blue Cross Blue Shield North Carolina's pre-approval list. GSK spokeswoman Sarah Alsbach says the drug maker typically offers coupons only for drugs for which there is not a highly rated generic. Separately, she says patients who do not take their drugs properly drive up costs, pointing to a New England Healthcare Institute study that estimated the cost of drug non-adherence at $300 billion annually. While the cost of medicines is only one of many factors that impact adherence to medicines, coupons can help patients adhere to the treatment regimens prescribed by their doctors by reducing the patient's out-of-pocket costs and helping to make the medication more affordable, Alsbach says. Doctors have largely tried to stay out of the fight, saying they want the patient's needs to come first. Both insurers and drug manufacturers are focused on the wrong issue. Money, wrote Stephen Keene, North Carolina Medical Society General Counsel and Deputy Executive Vice President for Government Affairs and Health Policy in an email. When a brand name drug is needed, that should be the choice. When a generic drug is available and will work, that should be the choice. But both insurers and drug manufacturers are continually pushing for financially motivated drug selection criteria entirely based on their own interest, not on the medical needs of the patient. And now, spotlight on law. Bankruptcy busts pile up in Triangle. By Chris Bagley, from Raleigh. It has been a bear of a year for indebted businesses and their creditors, with debts totaling more than $500 million landing in local bankruptcy courts. The 84 bankrupt companies reported a total of $545 million in debts on documents they filed in U.S. bankruptcy courts for the Eastern and Middle Districts of North Carolina. They range from a Durham barbershop to Cary Tech Companies to a once-promising pharmaceutical developer in Pittsburgh and include a heavy smattering of real estate developers in the Triangle and coastal areas. What they don't include are the two largest bankruptcy filers of all, Connection Technologies and Contract Research Solutions Incorporated. Two Cary-based companies that filed for bankruptcy in Delaware, where they are incorporated. Connection's Chapter 7 liquidation, which involves $470 million in debt and the loss of at least 250 jobs, is believed to be the largest bankruptcy in the Triangle's history. The load in 2012 is hefty by any measure. Comprehensive totals aren't available for 2011, but total debts in 2012's largest 15 bankruptcies outweigh the 15 largest of 2011, $368 million to $277 million. 15 bankruptcies in the region last year involved debts of at least $8.4 million. A total of 25 companies have topped that mark this year, and the year's not over. Several of the largest debtors are in information technology, life sciences, and other generally healthy industries. BioLex Therapeutics Incorporated of Pittsburgh filed a $38 million Chapter 7 liquidation in July after failing to move its hepatitis C drug into a final round of testing. Durham's Caraxis Pharmaceutical Corporation, which had pursued an Alzheimer's treatment for years, entered bankruptcy liquidation later that month, with $9.5 million in debt, including $2.2 million owed to the Durham-based clinical trials giant Quintiles. "We're getting away from residential developed lot sales," says bankruptcy attorney Trawick Buzzy Stubbs, who represents debtors throughout eastern North Carolina. "We're seeing more shopping centers, properties with cash flows, and more regular businesses, such as manufacturing." The largest bankruptcy filed in the Triangle since January was a Stubbs client, a limited liability company controlled by developer Harold Licton. The company has about $52.5 million in debt, including a $43.4 million loan on a pair of office buildings in Raleigh. BB&T sold the debt to a real estate company in Texas, which has been trying, unsuccessfully so far, to wrest away the buildings in the bankruptcy process. Stubbs says the court is scheduled on November 7th to review the company's Chapter 11 reorganization plan, which calls for the loan to be renewed with a five-year term. The Licton Company's debt and those of many other developers and builders has loomed since the real estate bubble's implosion in 2007 and 2008. Dramatically lower real estate values have altered loan-to-value ratios, forcing many borrowers to put up new collateral when loans come due. While that dynamic is common for borrowers who use real estate as collateral, it isn't limited to real estate companies. Chapel Hill attorney John Northern says, "Northern represents mostly debtors. His clients have accounted for $250 million of the $545 million in locally filed bankruptcies." For all the woes over collateral, Womble Carlisle bankruptcy attorney Bill Sullivan says he's starting to see a hopeful sign on that front. The market for distressed commercial real estate loans is growing, a development that is helping some debtor companies avoid bankruptcy. And now it's time for a better world. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. This article is entitled, "With a Global Background, She Helps Overseas," from the Philanthropy News Desk of Todd Cohen. Francesca Flory, the daughter of an American diplomat who worked for the U.S. Information Service, was born in Bolivia and raised in a number of developing countries, many of them in Latin America. As a college student, when her father was stationed at the U.S. Embassy in Pakistan, Flory spent a summer break working in the U.S. Immigration Office there, helping process paperwork for refugees who had fled from Afghanistan after the Russians invaded the country. "I was able to see firsthand from childhood the tremendous need there is in many of these countries and rural communities for basic and essential health services," she says. Now, after 26 years working on issues of international development and global health, most recently as Director of Global Health and Director of Program Management for Research and Innovation Solutions at the Gillings School of Global Public Health at UNC Chapel Hill, Flory has joined Curemerica's Global in Raleigh as Executive Director. founded in 1983 and operated with an annual budget of $1.7 million and a staff of 7 people in Raleigh and 2 overseas. Cure America's Global last year served 53,000 people living in 90 communities in 3 countries: Haiti, Liberia, and Guatemala. Its main focus has been working with local communities to identify and help address local health needs, particularly in the areas of prenatal and postnatal care. Through its community-based, impact-oriented strategy, the agency sends its staff into rural communities where they meet with every household to understand the key health issues and threats they face, then work with community leaders and educators to develop plans for supporting and improving health in their communities. Those plans typically can involve developing educational programs, building local capacity to deliver health education and care, and creating systems of support and care for pregnant women and for safe delivery and postnatal care. That often means working with traditional birth attendants or midwives, who often are the only local health care providers, Fleury says. Cure America's Global tries to team up with local partners. We want to engage them and empower them, she says. Its strategy is rooted in using programs based on evidence to show they work and on metrics to gauge performance. It's a business model that focuses on helping local programs build the capacity to sustain themselves. It has spun off and continues to work with its offices in Bolivia and Guatemala, which now operate as locally owned and managed non-governmental agencies. Cure Americas has a deep belief, not only in creating measurable improvements in the health of communities we serve, Flory says, but also working to develop sustainability. To have a broader impact, Cure America is working to participate in consortiums that focus on child survival. It has a contract with the Centers for Disease Control, for example, to work with underserved communities on HIV/AIDS education and prevention. Our organization's real vision, Flory says, is ending suffering in the world from treatable and preventable causes. This week's guest column is by Jennifer Nyes Connor. Ms. Connor writes for the Washington Business Journal, a TBJ sister publication. The wisdom behind whatever. Whatever. It might be one of the most loaded words in the English language. It's a charged, eye-roll accompanying phrase generally reserved for surly teenagers. Maybe that's why it can sound so ugly coming out of the mouth of an adult who should know better. Let me back up a bit. I'm a fall festival nerd. Pumpkin picking, apple cider, giant slides. A few weeks ago, I packed up the family and headed to Cox Farms preview weekend. It was one of those pristine September days, and we had the whole afternoon to just enjoy ourselves. My 5-year-old and I had just finished our first trip down the giant slide and giggling as we came to a stop. As we were collecting our burlap mats, my son stepped in front of a woman taking a picture of someone coming down the slide. I tried to pull him out of the shot, but didn't catch him in time, and that's when I saw it. She visibly rolled her eyes and shot a look of sheer annoyance at my son. Now, granted, he had walked in front of her picture, but we no longer live in the days of expensive 24 exposure film, and there was no reason for an adult to do that to a kid. I'm sorry, I said in half apology, half attempt to make a point, but he's 5. That's when I heard it. Whatever, she said, eyes rolling again. Did I really just hear that? I call you on being mean to a kid, and you reply, whatever, in a huff? You know, I said through my teeth in an uncharacteristically confrontational moment for me, that really wasn't very nice. I said whatever, she offered, and she turned and walked away. I damn near spit out my kettle corn. What burned me, aside from the fact that this nasty woman was mean to my child, wasn't merely the gall to act that way, but that she didn't cop to bad behavior when called on it. Because that means she didn't see it as bad behavior, which is not acceptable. Imagine this exchange occurring in your workplace. Would you ever roll your eyes at your boss? Blow off a colleague's comments with a snide, whatever? Of course not. So why is it okay to do that to a 5-year-old who's enjoying a fall day with his family? I don't know exactly, but I'm still chafed about it, and what and that says there must be a lesson here. We've all had moments of silent aggravation, but this was a reminder to me that they're often more public than we realize. Whether you're dealing with a colleague, a child, or a complete stranger, words, expressions, and tone all speak volumes. The little things matter. Capital City Surgery Center has received its Medicare license and a full 3-year accreditation from the Accreditation Association for Ambulatory Healthcare. The $17.6 million Ambulatory Surgery Center was formed earlier this year as a joint venture of WakeMed Health and Hospitals, local physicians, and Compass Surgical Partners, and the hospital has been recruiting physicians to invest in it. WakeMed still owns about 54%, but hopes to hit a 50-50 split sometime next year after another round of syndication offers, says Carolyn Knopp, WakeMed Vice President for Ambulatory Services. Some 41 physicians have invested in the center. The center is near the WakeMed Raleigh campus off New Bern Avenue in what hospital CEO Bill Atkinson hopes will soon become a superblock of medical providers with all types of specialties. Benefacting, a Durham-based tech nonprofit startup, is partnering with women's group Fem City Raleigh. The website benefacting.org allows users to trade their skills for donations to the charity of their choice, and it will join with Fem City to launch the Fem It Forward campaign. Fem City Raleigh members will use the website to volunteer their time or to donate goods in order to raise money for local charities such as Boys and Girls Clubs of Wake County. RTI International has started construction on a new biofuels research facility. The 3,000-square-foot energy technology development site will house a biomass pyrolysis reactor, a device that will allow RTI to produce oil from locally available sources, such as pine trees. The facility is designed to support $7.1 million of research. Once operational, it will be able to produce 1 ton of biomass a day, producing up to 60 gallons of pyrolysis oil per day. The oil could be substituted for petroleum in existing oil refineries. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. I'm Al Reynolds. Reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at trianglereadingservice.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.